DW Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum on DW. Deep and dirty in the world of science and technology. I'm Zulfikar Abani. And coming up, gesture control technology in cars. What if you sneezed and it changed the station on the radio?
I would be really wary of putting this kind of technology into vehicles. Our message to manufacturers would be that you fully test it out and you actually put the research in to find out what the effect is going to be on the driver.
Also in the car industry, do patents or does dropping patents effectively drive innovation?
Filing a patent doesn't mean to say it's a patent of any value. And if you look at China, for example, they're filing more patents than anybody else in the world. But there isn't a great deal of innovation coming out of China.
And how to get your granny online. All that and more right here on Spectrum. But first, when Steven Spielberg's film Minority Report was released in 2002 and we saw Tom Cruise's character, John Anderton, using gesture control technology, swiping information backwards and forwards as he needed, well, that was something straight out of science fiction. Indeed, it was science fiction. 12 years later now, we're in the present, it doesn't seem quite so far-fetched, all this swiping back and forth. We do it pretty much every day. Modern technology is allowing us to get hands-on in many ways with all of our gadgets, from phones to tablets and phablets and what have you. We're doing it all the time. And the next place we could be swiping and gesticulating is in our cars. Richard Murray got behind his wheel.
I've got into my car, opened the door and started the engine all without the use of a key. It's in my pocket and that's where it stays. But this light touch operation looks to be stepping up a gear with new technology just around the bend, which will allow us to control our vehicles with the wave of a hand. I could lift my hand to indicate. Give a swipe to change my route on my sat-nav.
At the end of the road, turn left.
Or turn on my radio. Motoring expert Steve Fowler is the editor-in-chief of Auto Express magazine in the UK.
Technology is the buzzword in the car industry at the moment. All sorts of technology to make life easier for the driver, one of which is gesture control. Possibly most sensationally, but it is coming, the Land Rover Discovery Vision concept that was unveiled at the New York Motor Show earlier this year features a huge amount of gesture control to control anything from the windscreen wipers and the indicators to even allowing passengers to gesticulate from an image that's shown on the side glass and pull some information onto a tablet screen that's sitting right in front of them. Whether it means you don't have to necessarily take your hand off the steering wheel, you wave your hand over a sensor and the indicator goes on. There could be ways to turn on the wipers, maybe even a gear selector.
Given their track record in all things technological these days, it's probably no surprise to you at all that Google is already in on the act on this, especially given their much talked about work trying to create a self-driving car. And whilst that might be a way off down the road, gesture control tech could be a lot closer, with the search giant filing a patent in the United States for just this sort of technology late last year. Their examples included swiping near to a window to open or close it, gesturing up or down next to the air vents to increase or decrease the temperature, or putting a finger close to your ear to turn up the volume of the in-car stereo. How will the system operate? Well, we don't know the exact details from the patent, as you'd expect, but experts believe it's likely to be either a 3D laser scanner or a depth-sensing camera with multiple lenses embedded around the driver in the car's cabin. But what do motorists think? I drove to the market town of Bingley in the north of England and asked a few.
If you waved another car out at a junction, you could turn your sat-nav off or something.
I love technology anyway, but anything that makes it easier.
Yeah, but then I think it'd be a bit distracting if someone...
Could be. I mean, yeah, you don't want to sneeze and change your radio channel. The demos I've seen, just brilliant.
I'm not sure it's a very good fit for cars, if I'm honest. The gesture control technology that I've ever used has never been 100% accurate and has certainly not worked all the time.
It could be useful rather than having to look down at your car radio or reach onto your sat-nav, because that takes your eyes off the road more.
Voice control would have probably been a better idea.
It would be something I'd be quite interested to try before I actually knew if it was a good idea and whether it would be practical to use every day.
But this kind of technology is already in operation. I'm here with Ben, who's 15. He's used to it because he uses it to play on the Kinect on the Xbox. And it's the same sort of thing that we're looking at. So, Ben, you're here playing a Star Wars game. Just tell us what it is that you have to do.
Well, you have to use body gestures, like sweep your hands side to side to block. There are some downsides to it. Sometimes the lightsaber gets into the wrong hand. Sometimes your character gets lost. It can be a bit unreliable.
So it seems people are yet to be convinced about gesture control technology in our cars, and that includes leading UK road safety charity Brake. Laura Woods is from the group.
Driving is actually one of the most dangerous things that most of us do on a regular basis. And you're operating them in an unpredictable and public environment. You're very much at the mercy of what everybody else on the road is doing around you, so you don't know when there's going to be an unexpected hazard. It's absolutely vital that driving has your full attention at all times. I would be really wary of putting this kind of technology into vehicles. Our message to manufacturers would be that you fully test it out and you actually put the research in to find out what the effect is going to be on the driver, how the driver will react to it, how the driver will interact with it, and if it's likely to cause a distraction.
Steve Fowler from Auto Express says he's sure that a risk-averse motoring industry, which spends millions of dollars a year on product development, will make sure they get all the details right, pass all the safety tests, and create a product that customers want. And he believes that in 10 years' time, gesture control technology will be commonplace in even the most basic cars.
The companies that tend to lead the way on technology are the companies that have the most money to spend. So it's the premium brands. Jaguar Land Rover really stole a march with the Land Rover Discovery Vision concept. Similarly, BMW, Mercedes, Audi, they're all brands that have led the way on technology and incorporating new technology into cars. But the car business is global. Who knows which other brands are knocking on the technology door? I know Volvo is looking at it very seriously. Expect to see it on the high-end cars first before it filters down to the more usual cars that you and I might be able to buy.
Now, if only the gesture control technology could have jabbed me in the ribs and reminded me I needed fuel when we passed the last filling station. This is Richard Murray for DW, stranded at the roadside near Bingley, England.
And last we checked, he's still there, in fact. The electric car developer Tesla sent a jolt of electricity through the industry when it announced that its patented technology was now open source, so in a sense free for all. It sounds like a gift to get the e-car market off the ground. With Harley Davidson entering the market as well, that's the motorcycle maker, there's got to be something to it, despite the remaining roadblocks that are stopping electric cars and bikes entering the fast lane. That's roadside charging stations and battery technology, to name a few. But is dropping patents, as Tesla have done in a sense, the best way to accelerate innovation? Marcus Costello has been looking into it.
In the lobby of Tesla's Palo Alto headquarters, there was a proud list of the company's patents on the wall. Tesla's CEO, Elon Musk, a man touted as the innovator of his generation, recently wrote on the company's blog, quote, "In the spirit of the open source movement for the advancement of electric vehicle technology, Tesla will not initiate patent lawsuits against anyone who, in good faith, wants to use our technology." The list came tumbling down and a thunder of congratulatory backslapping rolled around the web. There's no question, it's a bold move. But perhaps it's not all about environmentalism, and perhaps Musk doesn't think all patents hold back innovation. This is Dr. Tony Raven, chief executive of Cambridge Enterprise, a company that helps commercialise discoveries made at Cambridge University.
I think he's just following a very smart business strategy, which is known as co-opetition.
Cooperative competition. Co-opetition takes place when companies that are in the same market work together on research and development of new products. They stand to save a lot of money by sharing the cost, but you can bet they'll remain fiercely competitive in other areas.
His competition are the gasoline automotive manufacturers and their massive installed base of gas stations around the world. He can't make that change on his own. He's trying to install his charging stations to give people more confidence in cars. But he doesn't have enough money himself. The company has a lot of debt already. He can't do that task personally. So what he needs to do is get other manufacturers in, create a market, reduce costs, and get other people helping install infrastructure to his standards.
So Musk isn't giving free rein for anyone to come along and outright copy his cars. Just certain bits of his cars. The groundwork technology necessary to give others a leg up into the market. Because if the market for electric cars grows, then so too does Tesla's piece of the pie. This is Tom Hockaday from ISIS, Oxford University's commercialization enterprise.
From a commercial perspective, they're kind of taking a gamble that they think their brand is worth more than their patents in this particular case. And I think that's a perfectly reasonable position for them to take.
That is, a competitor's car based on Tesla's technology might be similar, but Musk hopes consumers will opt for the more established manufacturer, Tesla. You can be a strategic business person and a thoughtful environmentalist, but what doesn't work is saying one thing about patents and practicing another. This is Tom Higgison, Business Manager of Edinburgh Research and Innovation, the commercialisation enterprise of Edinburgh University.
He isn't saying patents are a bad thing because he's actually retaining hold of the patents for use by people that they choose. Yeah, there's a bit of a mixed signal from him on that. What he's saying and what he's actually doing seem to be quite different.
For all his statements about patents holding back innovation, Musk isn't prepared to nullify his own. Dr. Raven again.
He's still paying to keep those patents, and I suspect he will be filing a whole load more patents because they're well ahead of everybody else. So why not let the old ones go and help develop the market?
When you file a patent, in return for publicly disclosing the details of an invention, you get a 20-year monopoly on those details. You've got 20 years to develop that patented invention and make money from it without worrying that your competitors will offer the same thing. Given how expensive it can be to come up with a genuinely new product or service, a 20-year buffer to make your money back means inventors and companies are more willing to invest. But that doesn't answer the question of whether patents are good or bad for innovation. The arguments go both ways. In the winter 2013 edition of the Journal of Economic Perspectives, economists Michaela Baldron and David K. Levine wrote that there was no evidence that patents served to increase innovation and productivity. Here's what they said.
In spite of the enormous increase in the number of patents and in the strength of their legal protection, the U.S. economy has seen neither a dramatic acceleration in the rate of technological progress nor a major increase in the levels of research and development expenditure.
Higgison backs the system. It's his job to make sure research coming out of Edinburgh University gets the best deal when it leaves the lab and goes to market.
If you took the patent system away, that could be very detrimental to the innovative cycle. One of the effects could well be that everyone entrenches into secrecy, and the rate at which knowledge became public would reduce, and that would lead to a decrease in innovation.
Cambridge University's Dr. Raven says expecting to see a direct link between the number of patents filed and the number of new innovations won't necessarily give you the best indication of the system's effectiveness.
Filing a patent doesn't mean to say it's a patent of any value. And if you look at China, for example, they're filing more patents than anybody else in the world. But there isn't a great deal of innovation coming out of China. It will probably come in time. So I think you have to dissociate the numbers from the actual output.
But the system's not perfect. Higgison says it's open to abuse.
There are certainly potential abuses of the patent system, I think particularly in countries that tend to be very litigious.
Most of the litigation happens in the US.
That tends not to happen as much in Europe, for example. But where people treat patents not as something that protects your investment into your own future products, but as a separate commodity to be traded, then that's when abuses can happen.
He's talking about a practice known as patent trolling. A patent troll is someone who enforces patent rights in an attempt to collect licensing fees without actually intending to manufacture a product or supply a service based on the patent in question. In the case of Elon Musk and Tesla, we know the company wants its own products on the market, whether its technology is open source or not, so there's no trolling going on there. But perhaps in saying that Tesla will not initiate patent lawsuits against anyone who, in good faith, wants to use their technology, it's as much about collaboration and innovation as it is a means for Tesla to get the competition to come out of the woodworks and reveal themselves. And if that's the case, those three little words, in good faith, will be the true test of innovation.
Marcus Costello there, and you're listening to Spectrum with me, Zulfi Karabani, on DW. Online, we're at dw.de/spectrum, and you can follow us, as ever, on Twitter, at @DW_SciTech.
Digital Europe, bringing the continent's tech scene to your ears.
Some of the latest research suggests that elderly people are lonelier than ever. There's a growing body of support also that says that getting online can combat this sense of isolation, particularly in those people who are a bit older. But can teaching granny how to use Skype really be the key to a livelier social life and better health? A recent report by a UK think tank suggests it could. The report says about 4 in 10 people aged 65 and over in the UK do not have access to the internet at home. And it suggests that investing just over €1 billion to teach basic online skills would bring dramatic social and economic benefits to the country. But can the elderly learn to love tech, and do they even want to? In London, Anya Coopers has been finding out.
Rosemary Sargentson has come to an IT support drop-in centre run by the British charity Age UK to brush up on her internet skills.
I haven't learned very much so far.
How much do you know about computers?
Nothing.
A frail but elegant lady from southwest London who didn't want to give her exact age, Rosemary Sargentson has already completed a 6-week beginner's IT course.
Well, I thought at my age that it's a bit late in the day to start learning, but it suddenly struck me I ought to make an effort.
This cramped room with a view of the River Thames is the venue for a popular weekly IT support drop-in centre. It offers pensioners the use of 6 computers and an IT volunteer to answer their questions, free of charge. Rosemary comes to practice regularly.
Well, I was trying to learn about train times, but I'm not getting there very fast. I keep making a mistake and having to go back to the beginning again.
Is it very frustrating?
Sorry?
Is it very frustrating?
Yes, extremely.
Rosemary Sargentson would do well to keep practicing if it's true, as reports suggest, that getting online can improve the well-being and social lives of older people.
There are reports that 10% of retired people in the UK feel chronically lonely all the time, and getting online, having more interaction with local communities, could actually be of real benefit.
Eddie Copeland heads the technology policy unit at the think tank Policy Exchange. They've just published a report that says 800,000 elderly people receive only 1 visit a month or less from family, and that the World Wide Web could be the key to easing the sense of isolation.
There's a real problem there, which simple stuff like being able to use Skype or being able to use social media and find out more about what's happening in their local communities could be of real benefit for that particular generation.
The benefits would justify the significant expense, he says, which should be covered by government, the tech industry and the charitable sector. But how far removed are these recommendations from the real world, and how enthusiastic are older people about getting online?
Do you enjoy learning and coming here?
Not really. It's just something I think I ought to do.
A necessary evil?
Yes.
82-year-old Ernie Pilgrim visits the Age UK IT support drop-in centre twice a week. His wife used to type up the minutes of his social club meetings using a computer, but she died 3 months ago, and so now it's up to him. He doesn't find it easy, he says, nor does he need his new IT skills to improve his social life.
Do you see the internet as something that could help you keep socially active?
No, I'm not interested in that.
Why not?
I'm socially active in many other ways. I belong to 12 different organisations in London, in the city of London, and that is quite adequate for me.
According to the Policy Exchange report, it would cost £875 million, or just over €1 billion, to teach the 6 million people who lack basic online skills. Professor Thomas Kirkwood, Associate Dean for Ageing at Newcastle University, says any investment would be worthwhile, but that encouragement is needed.
For older people who have learnt a huge range of life skills, which they retain, but which are not based around the internet, there is a need for, you know, some training, some educational opportunities. But fundamentally, it's not a, it's a problem more of attitude than of investment and capability.
Kirkwood says offering an elderly family member a laptop or an iPad should never be seen as a sufficient solution to combating loneliness.
So connectedness through the internet is fine, but it is not adequate on its own. And we should not be looking for a kind of technological quick fix. We ought to be, sharing skills. The old give so much to us, and we learn so much from their accumulated life experience that we need to recognise that it's perhaps time for a bit more payback than is commonly delivered.
Back at the Age UK IT Support Centre, Londoner Alexandra Moore says she is now confident enough with her computer to be able to Skype with her daughter, who lives in New Zealand.
I mean, I have to say, you have no idea that sense of joy that the world suddenly becomes a small place and we were chatting. And so that's like a big hug. You know, it's wonderful.
And yet, despite her pride in her new IT skills, Moore says her computer can never replace real human contact.
It is up to families to remember they are families. You know, I sent a postcard to both my daughters today, just so the handwriting's there. Being involved with others is important, but if we only do it on a computer, then we are isolating ourselves.
Anya Coopers, DW, London.
Well, the month of Ramadan has begun. In the Islamic calendar, of course, it's a time when Muslims around the world are expected to fast during daylight hours. And many do, of course. It can be hard enough if you're healthy. But if you have diabetes, it's important to eat regularly in order to stay healthy. Now, a new study shows that some Muslim diabetes sufferers are putting their own health at risk during Ramadan because they either ignore their doctor's advice not to fast or they don't go to see their doctor at all. Lars Bevanger reports.
A group of worshippers gather at a Manchester hospital mosque for Friday prayers. Here the patients and staff can come to pray and to hear Imam Sadiq Diwan preach and recite the Quran. Praying is one of Islam's five pillars. Another is fasting during the month of Ramadan. But now research shows Muslim diabetes sufferers might be putting their health at risk by not following their doctor's advice on eating. Imam Sadiq Diwan is very aware of the problem.
So many a time I visit patients in the month of Ramadan and they have a very, very valid excuse not to fast. But because they've been fasting for 20, 30 years, they've never missed a fast. You can understand from where they're coming from. I mean, with tears streaming down their eyes, they're saying, look, Imam, I've never missed a fast, and now I have to miss a fast. So therefore, they feel that guilt.
In the Quran, it says that you are exempt from fasting if you are traveling, if you are sick, or if you're a female and you are on having your menstrual cycle.
Dr. Nisha Patel at the University of Manchester is the author of a report showing many Muslim diabetes sufferers will avoid their GPs during Ramadan because they're afraid they'll be told not to fast, even though the Quran allows them to break their fast in order to control their illness.
But then I ask them, so why do you carry on fasting? And that's when they say, well, diabetes, we don't believe it's a sickness. Some of them were afraid of actually going to talk to their doctor or nurse about how to manage their diabetes during Ramadan, mainly because of the fact they were afraid of being told not to fast. And they also felt that even if they tried to talk to their doctor or nurse, that they may not understand the significance of Ramadan.
Diabetes sufferers who fail to manage their diets could become seriously ill. and diabetes is up to 6 times more common in the South Asian population and 4 times more common in the Bangladeshi and Pakistani groups than in the general UK population. Dr. Patel's study suggests there needs to be more cooperation between doctors and local religious leaders in order to reach Muslim patients with the correct advice. Dr. Faizan Ahmed, a Manchester GP and himself a Muslim, agrees.
I think it's vital because that a lot of them, whether it's physical health, mental health, or any other matters of well-being, more often than not, particularly in the Muslim community, they might turn to their local Muslim scholars and leaders sometimes before they go and see their doctor, because they might see it as more an ailment of spirituality rather than a health problem.
Reaching patients with the correct advice is important, also because not all diabetes sufferers need to break their fast during Ramadan, as long as they know how to manage their condition. Kate Jones is a nurse practitioner at a GP surgery in Salford, near Manchester.
We need to make sure that patients who had a complication of the diabetes in the previous 3 months, we need to really think that these patients need to be exempt. But patients who have been well, we can look at changing the treatment for a little while. We can look at teaching patients to be checking their blood pressures, and we can teach patients to be how to eat at the time they can eat in the darkness. And the only thing that's really missing is education.
All diabetes patients are different, and as nurse practitioner Kate Jones points out, some, but far from all, can observe fast as long as they get the right advice for how to manage it safely. But to do it, that advice has to reach the patient. Imam Sadiq Diwan at the Manchester Hospital Mosque works closely with health professionals and advises his congregation to heed existing medical advice. Yet the best advice he can give, he says, is what the Quran itself says.
Now, with all due respect, good health is something every culture strives to maintain, and similarly Islam. So a pragmatic approach is always desirable. You should not feel that you have been religiously compromised. The Prophet has said, peace be upon him, that Allah loves those who takes the concessions he does give you. You know, so take the concession and don't fast. That would be our advice.
The second week of June was National Diabetes Week here in the UK, and several local councils staged special information events for the Muslim population. Things are moving in the right direction, but there's still a way to go before the gap between health and perceived religious duty is completely bridged. Lars Bavanger, DW, Manchester.
Well, that's just about all from Spectrum on DW for now. Don't forget, you can always keep up with our stuff at dw.de/science. Listen again or download the podcast at dw.de/spectrum, and we're also up at SoundCloud and iTunes, of course. Spectrum is produced and presented by me, Zulfikar Ebani, and our studio tech was Thomas Schmidt. Join us again next time if you can. Until then, thanks for listening, and bye for now.